So, Todd Brunswick, writer, producer, editor. We were talking a little bit offline. I had a chance to check out your IMDb, The Carnage series.
Yes.
Cannibals of Carnage, Zombies of Carnage, Monsters of Carnage. Todd, also from last I checked, you're in Michigan?
Just outside Detroit.
Detroit, Michigan. So, tell me a little bit more of the Carnage series, the filmmaking, the filmmaking scene in Detroit, and and what else is going on with you?
Well, I mean, Detroit's been, as far as like whether it's music, film, performance art, whatever, I mean, it's always had a very strong local scene. There's been a lot of movement. So it was about maybe, I don't forget when it was, whenever they had the big tax incentive came through, and Michigan had this, just like Louisiana's, right? Like pretty shady, but a big tax incentive, 40% back, blah, blah, blah. And I'd already been, my ex-wife and I at the time were already making movies going back to like, I think 2000, right? So it'd been a while. It was like 8 or 9 years after that they started the incentive, which just brought people flocking in to do like a national scene. We got like, there's a lot of great locations. And Michigan is still, it's Midwest. So it's got that vibe of like, you'd go up, roll up to a location to see if you could shoot or get permit, start talking to your location managers, working things out. And on a handful of things, you're like, oh, how much do we got to pay you? Like it's like that idea, like, oh, why you want to shoot it at my place? Like, this is a big deal. This is a thing. And they treat it like, like something really special and iconic versus just another day on the job, And so it was really a great environment as far as that, like very, a lot of community support. Whenever we'd roll up on a town and wanted to shoot or do whatever. So it's strong scene here as far as that goes. We got caught up in, the whirlwind of it. We started out real simple premise, and it goes back to like Avi Lerner and the guys, that were just selling movies hand over fist, put an exploding helicopter scene in, do this, do that, enough, boobs, blood and beast, and you're gonna be able to sell this thing. So really approached a lot of the filmmaking from a like a commercial perspective, like how can I sell this versus the burning desire to tell a story kind of thing. It's at the time, first marriage, we had 3 kids, and I was working in video, working in production already, as a director producer, and it was fine, it was paying the bills, but it wasn't like what I wanted to do, and I was with an agency full time, which was anywhere from 60 to 80 hours a week, and with little kids at home, it was just like, I don't want to hear about all these great things happening. Oh, first steps. Oh, it was, first tooth. That was, like, I'm just getting resentful about having to be in a job I love, but being on away from home, So how could I swing that around and go freelance basically? And that's kind of how the film thing came about. Like I went freelance, came up with one of the guys that I worked with on a regular basis. I did the Avi Lerner method, right? Like I came up with like 5 different titles, completely outrageous, some poster art for each one, and would just like put them together. Like, what movie would you go see? And Biker Zombies from Detroit. I don't remember what the other titles were, but that was the one everyone was like, I'd go see that one. Like, that's the one I want to see. And it was just some cheesy skull poster, whatever, but it worked, right? I was like, okay, that's the movie. Don't have a script yet, but people were already like, how much is it going to cost? Like, I don't know. It could cost, like, I don't know, 50,000. I don't know. It's like, I've never done an indie feature before. And I've heard from a million on down and so on. So it was kind of like, let me get into this and do a little reach. So we wrote it out over the summer, did a bunch of stuff. And then finally by that fall of 2000, we had a real solid plan and a budget and, investors and like a business, like everything was like set up and running from that first poster idea, and it just continued from there. And then as like you do, things get bigger and better and people start reinvesting in the profit, you get better distribution, you get better press and better exposure. And it got to a point where the budgets were, I wouldn't say getting out of control, but they were getting, it was, they felt like crap was just too excessive. You know what I mean? And we would have days, I'm sure you've experienced this, but there were days on set where we'd bring in bring in the truck and bring out, you know, they want to see that we'll lay out the, all the dolly track and do it just because the investors were coming by. So we'd have to put on this show of like, look at how all this money we're spending and how big and impressive it is. But not that all of it's going on, like, but not enough of it was going on the screen to make it worth freaking while anymore. And I was really, just kind of hit the wall. And then of course, the bigger the budgets, then at some point you're kind of just kind of cutting into your own profits. You know, horror fans specifically they want to be entertained and they want to be lied to. They want to be, you know, it's an engagement, right? And there's that relationship between the movie and the audience where you promise what you're going to promise, you deliver what you're going to promise, and everyone's going to have a good time doing that. And it can't be fake. It can't be cheesy. It's got to be it's a very authentic engagement, right? And real horror fans will know in a second if something hits or doesn't hit. Right. And if somebody's posing or doing whatever, right? So always keeping it that authentic. And bigger budgets didn't always mean better movies. You know, better production value maybe, but not necessarily. A story's a story. A script is a script. And it all starts there. If that's cool and that's got the hook, I think that works. So, so basically after a lot of years, 10, 11 years of doing it, I just hit, like I said, I hit a wall. Things were getting stressful, you know, marriage partnership is kind of rocky. All this stuff is like going on. And I just like needed to walk away from the money basically. So I came up with this Carnage series idea. I had a couple of distributors who were like, if I could get, you know, three or four of these a year, that would be fantastic. So we could just keep plugging this Carnage series over, like, you know, Aliens of Carnage and Voodoo Priest of whatever it was. Like, we just had Of Carnage was going to be like spin. And those happened to be the first three. And I financed everything myself for back to the old days of like, it's more like, hey, we're making a movie. You want to come and have some fun, pack a lunch. But here's the thing. After doing it for so long, we start, call is at 9 a.m. and we're out by 5. Like, I was doing 8-hour freaking days, and that's it. I'm not killing myself anymore. I don't want to kill the crew. And the thing was, we had a little formula down. We'd shoot them all. Like, really, it's 40 hours of production. So we would shoot, you know, starting, you know, Monday, and we would wrap Friday, sometimes maybe over. So I shouldn't say that. So it's 60 hours maybe, but we would wrap within a 7-day window of production. Everything was meticulously, like, again, planned out going in. The gags were already built and ready to go. We had, after doing this for so long, you're reusing stuff from, you know, whatever else you have laying around, and you got 6 extra gallons of, you know, blood made up over here. You got this laying over here. You got a bunch of nurnies and stuff you didn't use from the last one or whatever. And we just like kind of stockpile all this stuff in a garage and pull out, you know, storage, but whatever we needed, we just pull it out and use it. So, it's kind of like, you know, like Roger Corman and Avi Lerner style. Like, we knew what we had going in. We kind of knew the stories we wanted to tell, but we kind of knew where everything was coming from to begin with. So it's just like keeping the productions really lean and really tight. And not having to deal with the tax season, you know, being a small business still and having like a slew of investors like that. You're constantly quarterly reports, and this I was more running the business side of everything. And I wanted more shit I ever want to learn about taxes in my life. You know, I was like, I don't want to learn, I don't want to know this much. You know what I mean? That's what I have an accountant for, but I got to be in here signing off on whatever. And I just, it was not what I wanted to do anymore. The joy was gone. So doing the Carnage movies kind of brought back that visceral feeling of like, we're really making something. The scripts were what they were. The talent pool at the time was people we'd work with a lot off and on. And they knew, like, take the character, run with it, you know, like that kind of thing, make it your own your shit. And always there was, long as we got from A to B in the scene, I was fine. I wasn't a stickler for my dialogue, you know, like my dialogue has to be blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, if we get there and it feels good and it's organic and it's fine and everyone's reacting the way they're supposed to, you know, it was easy to do, you know, just let them roll, you know?
Yeah.
And again, knowing we're doing this for the idea of if they're paying too close of attention to whatever in the scene, that's awesome because they're really watching for it. You know what I mean? Like, they're really paying attention. It was just about, you know, just having a fun time. And we call them beer and pizza movies from the beginning, you know. So we're going to sit around, or we have, we ran these at a local theater. We ran Fright Night double features every Thursday night, where we would do double feature films. And it was very fan-based, fan audience participation kind of thing. And that was the crowd we were always making the movies for, where they're going to sit in there, throw popcorn and shit at the screen. They're going to yell and talk back. They're going to be, you know, whatever it is. Just that audience engagement, even in a movie theater, which was fun, because when when regular people were coming in to see the double feature, they had no idea that it was audience participation, you know. And we had beach ball, dodgeball. We had puppets going up inside the projection booth where we were, you know, interacting with people on the screen. And it was a different type of experience. And that's what those were all made for. So
yeah, I think that's like where the joy comes back. And touching upon, you know, that tax incentive, and touching going back to what you were talking about with Detroit and how, oh shit, there's a film in town, you know.
Right.
That's exciting. Everybody wants to be involved. I mean, Maryland used to have that. Maryland used to have some great tax incentives, and then they got rid of them. And you know, Veep. I was talking to a previous guest on the show about this, and how Veep moved out of Maryland and went to California, I think. And and I think they finally got this new Baltimore crime show, which is from the writer of The Wire, called We Own This City. And it's it's about the cops now. And but you know, the writer of The Wire, so The Wire was canceled. Hell, I think The Wire ended in 05 or 06.
Yeah, I just say mid, yeah.
And we had House of Cards, and that's gone, and Veep, which is gone. And now it looks like Richmond, things are starting to blow up in Richmond. I think maybe Virginia's got this new, you know, tax thing, because there's a lot of productions going to Richmond now, especially the historic stuff, the AMC, the AMC stuff, the Discovery stuff is going to Richmond, and all these, and the PBS stuff, and all these you know, historical period pieces that are taking place in Virginia and on the lots of land out there. But I think there's more modern day stuff being done in Richmond now, and I think that's due to the. But I remember, you know, I graduated college 04, you know, film and TV, and there was a number of these independent films or independently produced TV pilots that I was jumping on. I was getting first AD or second AD you know, production coordinator or a co-producer or something on these films. And you had a swarm of people just wanting to jump on, like, hey, I'll do anything. I'll PA. And you start to see all the same faces, because it is a small market. It's a small pond.
Yeah.
But people are just so quick to jump out there and want to jump on this independent project. And then you've got, you know, V for House of Cards or Wire. And I think we also had out there for a while, for a couple of weeks, each movie we had Die Hard 4, Live Free or Die Hard. And then we had National Treasure 2. And both of those films, you see all the same faces. Everyone's just all the local. Right.
Yeah. And then again, that's how, you know, when it, here, and probably the same thing there, before the tax incentive was available, right? It was those same people are already working in the business. You know what I mean? Like the crews that I had worked with for those first, you know, 7, 8, 9 years, we all knew each other, you know, like we, everybody knew somebody doing whatever, you know, and it was a very, I want to say very collaborative. And, you know, like if you could get, you know, whatever DP and so on, you know, like there was that, like everyone knew and was trying to get something worked out. So like, well, we're going to move this over because so-and-so is available to shoot, you know, the following month, whatever it is. So, okay, fine. We'll back that off and do that. So, and then we can help support. And that was great. And it felt like when the incentive came and everyone was fighting to get on those big, like the big, excuse my language, but it's just like, it felt like big shit shows, you know. It's like people who were all of a sudden becoming, well, I'm working on Transformers, or I'm working on whatever Hugh Jackman flick is going to be, you know, and I'm not going to do these little indie films anymore. And I'm like, well, that sucks, because you know, it's like we were all friends until the big guys came in and started like pulling all the shots. And it's kind of disheartening. Also, the incentive From the get-go, it was not sustainable. And that was the heartbreak of it when it finally came and it sounded so good and everyone was really excited about it. And, you know, I think it was Jeff Daniels and Mitch Albom were the two like local known celebrities who were like really pushing this stuff, you know, forward. But, you know, the 40% rebate, blah, blah, blah. There was nothing holding that to Michigan. You know, it was just kind of like, hey, come in here. We're going to give you all this money back for every dollar you spend here, but it's every dollar you spend, not every dollar you spend here. So mm-hmm. you don't have to hire local people. So there were like really like veteran coordinators in production and UPMs or whatever, who were basically down to like PA roles making squat, but they were on the big film, you know, and, or some guys were like swinging hammers again on construction jobs. And it's just like, wow, these guys were like leads, you know, they were building this stuff 2 years ago. Now they're like swinging a hammer with the crew and getting paid accordingly, you know. And it was kind of like heartbreak because all the big jobs came in and were paid right back out to the people that it, like you do, you find your group.
Yeah,
they were all and, LA based or whatever.
And
all the money was going right back out there. It wasn't staying here.
That's what blew my mind with National Treasure 2 came out and they flew PAs out.
Right.
And House of Cards. Yeah. And House of Cards was, you know, based in Northern Maryland, but they had all their PAs from New York and they were putting them up.
Yeah.
And I'm like, do you have any idea how many PAs you have in this area? I mean, you're hiring.
You know the business, right? And you know, nothing against LA or New York, but their heads are so far up their own side of the business that you don't see outside your bubble, right. You know?
Yeah.
They just don't. They don't. And why? And you know, and I've been there when I'm putting X amount of dollars on the line for whatever project, I want a known factor, not a flyer. You know, it's like there might be really good PAs in Baltimore. If I don't know any of them or I don't have a trusted source to, you know, bring them in for me, you know, so I could kind of see both sides, but also it was, and it's like anything else. It was like, you know, the money's going to go where the money goes. And it's not about building an industry. It's about people cashing in and getting their shit quick and bailing, yeah. You know, and we had productions literally walk out on their bills from a lot of towns, you know, or have X number of storage units full of, you know, gear and props and whatever, and just like skip out on the bill and some location guy or some coordinator stuck with, like, cause it was in their name or they, you know, like they did the thing and they were the contact person. And there's like, we got, you know, whatever it is, like three units of prop stuff sitting over here. What are we going to, you know, like, it's yours, your responsibility. You're like, it's not mm-hmm. mine. It's the movies. But they're getting the bills for it and they're submitting it on and like auction it off. I don't care, you know, but I don't want it, you know? And it was harder after that left, like in 2010, 2011, where the bulk of it went away all of a sudden, going back out to try to shoot in certain locations. And there was a local police chief that I worked with a lot. And, actually I ran into him at like the post office or something, right? Out of the norm. And he's like, you know, you really kind of screwed us over. And I was like, how did I screw you guys over? He's like, well, we've been working with you for years and everything was paid on time and you stood by what you said and we'd never had an issue and it was this thing. And he said, and then these, you know, guys come in from wherever and they've got a baseball, whatever they were doing. And he says, they stuck my cops with overtime. They had all this stuff that they asked for and we catered to, but like skipped out on the bill, you know, and now it's like, we're stuck and trying to collect. And I'm like, they suck. You know, it's like they don't care about you guys. You know, it's like we live here, it's a different thing, you know, and
yeah,
it's our town, our state, whatever you want to call it. But yeah. So it was heartbreaking at the same time as it was really exciting for a lot of people. And then, you know, the ones that were working and got on good, they moved to Atlanta or they went out to New Mexico or, you know, they went down to Louisiana. They're like, hey, we're out of here, you know. So they left, you know.
Hey, listen, and you get that too, because, you know, it's, for the most part, the work kind of dried up in the DMV.
Sure.
You know, fast forward, you know, to 2015, anywhere between 2015 and 2019, I was doing so much acting and all. I played a detective this or officer that, law enforcement and military roles and all those ID crime shows, you know, those.
Right, yeah.
You know, those crime shows and Investigation Discovery.
Yeah. Reenactment, I think, yeah.
Yep. Because Discovery Channel was in Silver Spring, Maryland, their headquarters was. And so there's a bunch of production companies in town. I am producing pretty much all those shows are produced in DC, Maryland, or Virginia.
Right.
And I was probably in one episode per season of every of those shows as a detective, as a sometimes as the stepfather. I might get that generic role. I can really kind of broaden my horizons. Right. I'll be the perp, or I'll be the stepfather that finds the body. But usually it's detective this, officer that, sergeant this, lieutenant that, whatever. And so again, you know, Discovery's headquarters moves to New York, I think. And so two out of three of these production companies left and went to Maine or Connecticut or New York or New Jersey or something close to Discovery. But one stayed, and they're still producing a number of shows because you can't, there's Dropbox and Google Drive. Like, why does your whole production have to uproot?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that happened. You know, we saw that with the, especially now that the pandemic, that first hit, it was like, I think the first, I did two on like with a mask jobs, right? Like I was on set for two or three, doesn't matter. It was a couple, three small things that I actually had to leave my house for as a writer, producer, you know, like I was just coordinating, you know, and a lot of the stuff was in studio, but it was different, and it really brought out, there was something going on, and the company I was working for was out of New Hampshire, you know, and they're like, hey, we got your name from this thing, and we're just coordinating here, and we're doing between Detroit, Chicago, and Cleveland. Can you help out? And I'm like, yeah, sure. I'm kind of in the middle. So it was 4 or 5 days, but I didn't have to leave. I didn't have to leave my living room, you know, and it was, you know, you're busting your ass, but it was like, it was all said and done in 5 days. And, the footage looked great. Everything was going off like it was supposed to, but the crews that were going out and shooting were like, it was like a DP, you know, and acting as his own operator, one assist, and then a couple of gaffers and a grip, you know, it's like, that was it, you know? And there was one or two sound people. So the crews were like seven people were going out to get the stuff and working with whatever on the thing. And we were doing video feeds to the camera. So we had a monitor set up on site for the interviews where I could be, and the people in DC and New Hampshire could all be on the same thing, talking to the talent or coaching the talent or the DP from wherever, you know. And it was unusually, but it was also really super cool and efficient because we were running multiple locations simultaneously for these shoots. And it was like, we're all, you know, I don't know how you put it, but it just felt really effective. We had three crews in three different cities doing what they were supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
The main group of us could be there and each one have an ear and eye on something that's happening somewhere else and get a lot done in a 6-7 hour day, 8 hour day. You could really crank out a lot of stuff that way. So,
yeah. I mean, you know, going back to what you were saying, it's about, you know, like finding that bottom line on your productions. And it's like, you know, you're aiming towards horror. You're aiming towards horror fans, and we know what horror films are, and you're, you know, finding pretty much the bottom line. And, you know, from the last 15 years, 20 years, me and my colleagues were like, you know, what are we making that's ours? I mean, don't get me wrong. I love being on TV.
Sure, right.
If you were to go to ID now, you could find a whole shitload of stuff that I'm in. Right. But you know, what are we making that's ours? And we were always trying to, you know, come up with a web series, come up with a YouTube's always been our medium because it's free. And it's, I mean, you just upload it to yourself and people watch YouTube.
If you find
that perfect tag and that perfect hashtag. Right. But, you know, so, you know, like I was saying, I was acting in all those crime shows, all those ID crime shows. Mm. And I started asking questions and I realized how cheap these shows are, watching them back on TV and so obviously I'm acting in the dramatic reenactments, but when I see the final product, I'm seeing the experts, the criminologists and the police that were involved and the psychologists or whatever sitting against the screen screen. Okay. Right. That's too easy.
Too many interviews. Right.
Yeah. And then realizing that's what the show, the script or the outline is written around. Is you get a couple professionals talking about this one criminal. And so me and some colleagues, we put together two different crime shows set in Marvel and DC. Okay. The idea was, you know, hey, if Bruce Wayne goes home back to the Batcave, takes the cowl off and has a cocktail and watches ID, what's he going to see on ID? you know, Bruce Wayne. So we created one, and it was okay. Bottom line, absolute, like, no money production type of deal. So, you know, come up with basic scripts, you know, it's pretty much a supervillain origin.
Right.
I handmade a freaking teleprompter, had a couple of my colleagues just sit in front of a green screen, read the teleprompter. I did it myself. And like with a little scroller in my pocket, I'm rolling. I mic'd myself up. I'm rolling. I'm scrolling this thing with my thumb. I'm reading the teleprompter and acting and playing a different character myself. And then, you know, you've got some found stuff. You could use some of those comic, use some of the comic sketches. You can find them online.
Right.
And we went to Comic-Cons and we filmed cosplayers. And those would be dramatic reenactments. You got your forensic sketches, which would be the drawings. The panels. That's it.
I love it, man. Freaking genius. Yeah.
And so we did that because it's like, okay, you know, Marvel and DC are huge right now, but the crime shows are huge right now. But on YouTube, the supervillain origin stories and superhero origin stories are huge right now. But what did Marvel build their whole basis on was all the B characters. So DC decides to do the Suicide Squad based on even worse, like C and D characters.
Right, yeah.
So we chose to, you know, do supervillains that I've never heard of. I've been, you know, kind of a DC and Marvel fan since Christopher Reeve's Superman and Superman 2.
All right. Okay.
But I'm and some comic book reading and a lot of cartoon watching and then movie watching, and then I'm seeing some of these bizarre freaking supervillains. Those would be the ones that, you know, we do a piece on. So that was like one of our big projects. And during quarantine, it was, oh Christ. Now, all right, my wife ain't letting nobody over until we're fully vaccinated. And so two of my colleagues were fully vaccinated. So I said, okay, you guys are coming over, sit in front of the green screen, come over one day a week for 3 weeks, 8 hours, 6 hours a day. I'll buy a lunch.
Right.
And we just shot script after script after script. And then, you know, I go to bed with the wife, you know, watch a little bit of, you know, fall asleep in front of Seinfeld or something. And once I hear her, you know, gently snoring, I'd slip out, get dressed, put makeup on myself, do my scripts, you know, for three hours every other night during the quarantine. But the biggest thing was put out a casting notice to voiceover actors and say, hey, here's the deal. You know, it's deferred payment. It's a web series, Google ad pay, Google AdSense, all that stuff.
Right.
But during quarantine, so many voice actors had built their home studio. I had built my own studio for the podcast and for remote gigs, but I even did a couple of voiceover gigs myself remotely. Mm-hmm. So I reached out to these voiceover actors and I said, hey, here's scripts. Here's the deal. You know, it's a web series, blah, blah, blah. And MP3s, emails of MP3s is coming in. Slap them in. Don't even need to. My direction was, here's some of the real world, real ID shows that are actually on ID in our real world. Here's our series so far. You know, sometimes I get a phone call. Hey, how do you pronounce this? Or what's your general direction with that? I'm like, too easy. Da, da, da.
Yeah.
Emails upon emails are just these MP3s and just start slapping these episodes together. Quarantine, you know, awesome. Like I only had two people come over. That's when I finally got fully vaccinated, and then and they got fully vaccinated.
Right.
And it's like you said, it's you know, you find some bizarre little market, little corner, little niche thing. Hopefully it gets clicked.
I think that's the power of, like, and I've been a big proponent of that from the get-go. Like I was never I'm not trying to sound whatever, but like when I was first coming into the business, late 90s, early 2000s, there were like film purists. Like, it's got to be shot on 16 or it's got to be this or that, whatever.
Oh, can't brother.
Can't go digital. And I was looking at, I think it was the Canon XL1s and the first digital camcorders, right? I'm like, yeah, this shit's pretty awesome. And we can shoot for days. And we can shoot as much as we can, let that shit roll. We can get three or four of these cameras rolling. And it's just like, and there's like no cost to doing it. And then, of course, you know, there was the first, like, you know, Adobe Premiere and, you know, whatever, past the video toaster days, you know, where, you know, don't know how if you remember those, but we're on the edge of something here that's really great. And there's no more like clips that you're cutting, and you're no more spice. You know, you're out of the old Steenbeck flatbeds. You know,
yeah.
This is a new wave of really cool, and you can shoot forever. And I think it was one of the guys that used to, you know, John Cassavetes and that New York crew that were just shooting all the time, right? With Peter Falk and Jenna Rowland and all that. So one of the guys that used to shoot with them a lot said, man, if we had this kind of shit, this digital stuff back in the day, he says, we could have done 100 more of these goddamn movies, you know? And that was my, like, I embraced that completely. Like, it took nothing to sell me on the idea, like, I could do this for cheap, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you got good looking stuff and you can make it if you want to. Even then, there were early like 16 millimeter filters if you wanted to put a goddamn film filter on it. But it reminded me of a decade or so before when CDs were first coming out and they were putting the record hiss on the CD because people were blown away by it sounding too fucking clear. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Is how it's supposed to sound? Like, that's brilliant, you know? But they're like, no, we got to put a record hiss on it because it's too much. People can't, you know, whatever. I was just like, okay, let go, you know? So shooting forward, it was always about whatever the new thing is, you know? And I, you know, friends of mine, you know, Asylum and some of the other smaller, like, movie companies that were always cranking them out hand over fist, you know? And I love those guys. And they had the Mockbuster thing going for a long time. And it was a brilliant model. I loved it. And I just appreciate like carnival barking marketing like that, where you're able to get, you have a shit ton of fun making it. But hey man, sorry about my language. I realize I'm like talking.
That's fine.
But it's really about like getting it out there and just having fun doing it, you know? And like you were saying, a buddy of mine who a lot of things that happened now in quarantine. So there was a movie I started, we shot it. It was a great thing called Slab we did back in 2010. And my dad got sick after I was like his primary caretaker for the last really 6 months that, you know, he was with us. Yeah. And I just kind of like chucked it all. Like, I didn't want to touch the movie. I was just in a weird place, you know? And I'm like, you guys go do what you got to do with it. I'm done. I just kind of walked away. And they didn't really want to finish it because it was kind of like my baby for a couple of years, like my thing and whatever. But this one guy, anyway, kept asking like Slab update, like when's it coming, when's it coming, when's it coming? Because we did cut a trailer at some point, like right before with enough footage, you know, from what we had, and saying it was going to come out Halloween 2011 or something like that. And it was it was forgotten. And I was like, I just don't want to go back. It's kind of do I want to go back and relive all that, you know, whatever. And then I had a flood in my basement and all the hard drives that I had, all of my master drives and shit, and just got trashed on, they got flooded, right?
Yeah.
We had a massive flood in the basement. And, even though they were all in whatever tubs and I thought they weren't watertight, obviously. So, so I lost it all. And I'm like other than the stuff I still had on HDV tape masters, you know, from back in the day, the rest of them were, the drives were all trashed, you know? And, so just a few weeks ago, well, maybe a month ago or whatever, one of the guys I worked on that film with was like, hey, I heard so-and-so had a backup drive with a DP, had his own backup drive of all the footage. I was like, oh no shit. So I reached out to him after, you know, I see him, whatever, but, I reached out to him and was like, hey, he's like, man, I think I got it, but I don't know if I could even spin that drive with like, that was 10 years ago, you know, like,
right.
Where am I going to find cable and who's got an operating system is going to even read that thing?
Geek Squad, man. Geek
So it turns out we got it. So, but then I was like, I lost, with that, I lost the script notes, like everything, mm-hmm. It's all gone. And they're like, well, let's get it back together. And I'm like, that's like 4 or 5 months worth of work. Cause we got to literally like go through every single shot that we did when they're time stamped. I'm like, that's awesome. Do you remember what day we shot what? Like, I don't remember any of that shit. Like it was 10 freaking years ago. And then we got to put it all back together. I don't have a script anymore. I can remember the idea of the movie. I don't know. I don't have any notes, you know, like to edit with. So it's going to be, and very intense, long process. Do you really want to dive back into that? And everyone just kind of got exhausted after the conversation going, yeah, that's like a lot of work. I'm like, it's something you can pick up and put down. Maybe, you know, I said, but it's nothing that's going to happen right away, you know? Because we're working on this other thing, same kind of thing. Like how can we do something on the cheap that's going to be this and that, whatever. And so we came up with our own series. Was it Dr. Geiger's radioactive TV hour? And it's, you know, we're going to be watching public domain titles, you know, are going to be playing in the background. And we're going to have this mad scientist who's doing his, if we call it his hypno something ray, where he's trying to, like, brain, you know, pinky in the brain, like he's going to take over the world. Like every episode is how him and his assistants are going to take over the world with his hypno ray. And the experiment obviously goes badly wrong. And one of the assistants winds up, like Kenny from South Park winds up, we call it the respawn cast member. Like they die in every episode and then miraculously come back as a different character, but it's the same actor, you know, same thing. So, and we're shooting it like it's all green screen and everybody's got their thing. And some of the gags we have to all be in person for, the rest of it, we don't have to be. And that was kind of the mapping out how we can all be in our separate places, shooting what we need to shoot, and having that interaction. And yeah, same thing. I think like every like 3 days out of the month, we all have to meet together on the stage and shoot our stuff against the green screen. And our stage is the garage. Like we're using the garage. Yep. You know, it's like, hey, we'll just go this one and we can shoot it there. 3 days a month, you know, we get all of it in and that's it.
A lot of people learned a lot of tricks. And a lot of, you know, a lot of people have said this to me on the show and just in life, necessity breeds innovation.
Yeah. Mother invention. Yeah.
Necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. If not, yeah. But especially like innovation and evolution and, you know, working around just all these workarounds and these production hacks you know, like, hey, here's this bizarre idea and we can make it work remotely because of this, that, and the other thing. And it'll look weird.
And it's like you said, at the end of the day, you know, because this was a thing, and I think a lot of people in the business, filmmakers, they get caught up on, oh, I'm shooting Black Magic this, or I'm editing this, like, and never once, and I don't care from like Paramount and Lionsgate on down to like distributors I've worked with, have they ever freaking cared what camera you use to shoot? They could give a shit what you shot it on.
Right.
Moreover, I've never been at a screening of any film where the audience comes out of there determined to figure out what camera they shot that on because it looks so blah blah blah, or what sound mix did they use. It's like they don't care. That's our filmmaker ego getting in, like, I gotta have this or whatever. And there was a guy at Lionsgate years ago after, so we had a movie, Mr. Jingles, I got took out by Lionsgate, right? Surprise to us. We shot on that Sony or the Canon XL1 DV cam in like 7 days with a bunch of students from a local broadcast school. You know, like it was just like an experiment. We shot it in like 7 or 8 days. It was, we did buy lunch though, you know, from when we got like the dollar menu at McDonald's and like the $5 Little Caesars pizzas that you get, like, anyway. Mm-hmm. So it was like that kind of thing. And I think it was maybe $3,000 or $4,000, literally out of pocket, and a small group of people wanted to put money in, $500 here, $50, whatever the hell. And our rep calls us saying, hey, sit down, because like we've sold the movie. And I'm like, fuck, really? That's great. And it's like, and then Lionsgate came up and I fell over. I mean, I'm dying laughing, going, have they seen it? Like, have they seen this thing? Like, really, Lionsgate? They're like, yeah, Lionsgate's taking it out. So it was exciting as hell. I'm like, that's great. And the money was, you know, everyone was ecstatic because it's like the money that we got bought out for that film was unbelievable for what we made, what we did. Yeah. And it's a big success story, you know. And then a couple years, and then it looked great when the DVD came out and you see the cool like red Lionsgate, you know, their horror logo for the red, you know, the red Lionsgate opening and all that stuff happens. And then we cut right to, bam, the murky DV cam footage from the Canon, you know, it's like at night on a house with not even lit, and just like, oh my God, it like I can just hear the people groaning at home while they're watching this. Yeah, like, what the fuck did I just rent this for? You know, like that kind of thing, right? Yeah. So, but at the same time, ecstatic, like we pulled that off, like Lionsgate took this, like I was just astonished that it, like, that could happen. So, a couple years later, I'm meeting with the guy who, Steve Yan, was the guy at the time at Lionsgate Acquisitions VP, and we're talking. He's like, hey, well, let you know, like, we don't care, obviously, what the movie was shot on, if it's a decent story and this happens. And he says, I don't care. I don't care. Nobody cares. Nobody cares. And he says, but you got to be really happy with the numbers on that thing, because we found out that that little under $10,000 movie went on to gross like over $2.5 million for Lionsgate. I'm like, wow, that's freaking awesome. And he's like, we got to be happy with the back end. I'm like, we were a buyout, man. we got no back end on that. He's like, well, that sucks. And he just like closed the book on us. And he's like, so what else you got? And I'm like, it doesn't matter. You know, it's like, I'm crestfallen at the moment. Like, we could have held out for like, there was no way, you know, they were going to buy it, do what they wanted to do in it. And they got us cheap after that $2.5 million price tag was mentioned. I was like, boy, you guys,
yeah,
you know, I think we, yeah.
Well, going back to like the DV cams, I mean, for me, I think my generation was the rise of the DSLRs.
Yeah, sure.
And you know, and I got one for $750. It did 1080. It did 1080, 24 frames per second. So it was shooting film, sure, quality video.
Sure, absolutely.
And it was just, once I bought one and a colleague of mine bought one, it was a two camera setup on a couple of indie films, a couple mm-hmm. short films, a whole handful of music videos,
sure,
some bizarre other web series that we were experimenting with, and right. It just never ended. And I think now, you know, he's got a $10,000 or $15,000 small little one of the Reds.
Okay, yeah, the Reds,
you know, like
yeah,
the small little one. I think yeah. It's called a Dragon or a Ninja Dragon, or something yeah. like that. Mm-hmm. And you know, he saved up. He made so much money on all these other projects using the DSLRs. Now he's got a pocket sized freaking Red.
Yeah, and, no, it's awesome.
But you got to think about like, okay, these cameras are so much smaller with so much more disk space and so much and the yeah. room for takes is so much grandiose. Like you were saying, if Cassavetes, John Cassavetes had this,
right,
he would have been shooting so many more films. And it's lightweight. You can just slap it on a Steadicam. The Steadicam rig is probably heavier than the camera.
Heavier than the camera now. Yeah.
Now you got the Ronin, and you're right. just gonna hold this Ronin thing, and it just floats.
Awesome. Yeah, yeah. No, it's amazing. Yeah, yeah. It's cool.
Yeah, the little slider racks.
Yeah.
I have this small jib arm that fits in the back of my truck.
Sure.
DSLR on top of that's nothing. I mean, you need like a small little two. You don't need a bunch of plates. You know, you don't need a bunch of 10-pound plates. You need like two and a halfs,
right?
To balance it out. You know, it's tiny.
I had a DP show up with. We were gonna do a shot, and we wanted to do a crane shot, and he literally had like PVC tubing with the cool little mount on the end with a platform for the camera. And then he just had literally fish line on the front of that. So as it's the pole is going up, he's watching on, he's got a little phone, you know, on his iPhone monitor. He's just got his, he's watching, and he's just like, run. And I'm like, you're running the freaking, it looks like a $10,000 shot, and it's PVC tubing and fish line on a rig. I'm like, it's freaking brilliant, you know, yeah. because it's small enough, light enough. You could, you know, you're able to shoot it that way. And it looks like $1 million. And then now with drones and whatever else. But yeah, it's I love the advent of the DSLR, especially back in the day, because I think was it Canon Rebel series where it mm-hmm. had like the first little, what were they, the TSI?
I had the T2i.
T2i, right. T2i, and you could buy those at Costco for, I forget whatever, it was cheap, right? Like a couple $100, whatever it was, $300, whatever, something like that. But you can buy them at Costco, and if you're a member of Costco, there's a no hassle return policy, whatever. So you could go buy four or five of those, go shoot whatever the hell you had to shoot for that week, box them back up, and take them back, and then like ta-da, like you know your camera absolutely nothing.
Holy crap!
Yeah, I mean I had to do that a few times, but and I was inspired. That was a couple of these kids in Cleveland. They were like skater kids, right, back in the day. And they would go to Costco or Best Buy or whatever and buy the little flip camera, not flip cameras, but little flip out like DV handheld Sony cams, shoot these amazing like action skateboard movies, right? Just these little cool things. And of course, there was like murders happening, whatever else. It was bloody and it was just gory, cheesy stuff, but it was all high action, really, really amazing stuff. And that's what they did. They got their mom's credit card. They were in high school, got their mom's credit card, go to Best Buy, getting these things, they shoot over the weekend, take them back, get the money back, you know, whatever. And I'm like, you guys are freaking brilliant. And they were at a show, a convention called Cinema Wasteland out in Cleveland. And they're selling these DVDs for like 10, 15 bucks a pop. I'm like, you guys are freaking brilliant. You know, like, that's awesome to do.
Yeah.
Know, that kind of insight, but yeah.
And that's brilliant because, you know, my wife and her friends, they're notorious for buying a dress.
Right.
Going out on a night in the town, you know, or a big date. Right. And then returning the dress.
Sure. Yeah. Why not?
You know, women are notorious for that. And
yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, there's definitely like your workaround for that budget. And
sure. You can do a lot of things. Yeah.
You know, a budget production hack. So Todd, what's next on the agenda? What's the next set of plans? Next set of goals. What's next on the agenda?
Well, right now we're putting that series together. We're shooting the series, the Dr. Geiger series, which is, it's a goof. I mean, you know, it's kind of like we used to do at the Fright Nights, but like on screen, except it's more skit driven. We have some more skits in there. And it's got the running gags. They're 10 episode seasons. So the arcs are pretty simple, you know, straightforward. And like you were saying, we're not trying to kill a market here. We're going after that niche people that get what we're trying to do and enjoy what we do. I'm 51 years old. I'm beyond trying to like go out there and like, I put in my time as far as that goes. I'm doing this because it's fun. It's relaxing and I enjoy it. And, cool. I hope people don't, I do too. I mean, I'm not, you know, begrudging, but if you get what I get, you're going to like this, you know what I mean? And that's kind of a whole approach to the whole thing. Even after like kind of how we did the Carnage movies and everything else, like, you either get what we're doing or you don't. And we're not trying to convince you, you got to like it or that we're the greatest thing since whatever, because that's certainly not what we're here for. It's like, but if you think we had a good time making it, you're right. It was a lot of fun. And if that kind of comes through, then that's even better. You know, I've done enough festivals and I've done enough whatever. And I never got the taking yourself that seriously about what you do. Like, you can have passion for a project. That's awesome. And you can have, and I've got those. I've got like a couple of vanity projects that I know are just like, it's going to be for me. There's never going to be an audience that wants to hear about some 60 something single guy, blah, blah. You know, it's just a slice of life movie, you know, like, what was it, Broken Flowers or something, you know, it's not going to happen. It's like, people aren't going to care. And I'm not Jim Jarmusch, so I don't have whatever. So fine. But yeah, there's some stuff I want to do like that, that I will do. And it's just like, I wrote a book under an alias, and it's fake, you know, it's all bullshit, but and that's fun. That was kind of fun. It was a good exercise to like coming from screenplay or writing this to writing a novel where, I don't know, like, I'm just so used to like, oh, they're going to see this. They're going to, like, I don't have to tell anything. They're going to see this happen. They're going to see this happen. I don't have to explain it. To where my publisher and my editor were like, you got to tell me what the hell's going on here. Like, cause we don't, one word, you know, exterior, night, rain, like they don't get it. Like,
right.
What the hell is that mean? Like, well, how was the storm? Was it stormy? Was it the light rain? Was it a thing? I'm like, I don't know. We'll just show it in the thing, you know, like, and we'll adjust the rain. I don't know. So you don't have that. It's just a different muscle, you know, to get in there and have to. So actually I read a lot of David Lynch scripts. Blue Velvet in particular, because just how detailed his writing is as the director and, you know, like, everything that you see on screen happens in the screenplay. I'm like, oh, that's what, they're long to read. You know, it's a long read, but that's a novel. You know, like, I get it now. I see what he was doing there. So off on a tangent, but yeah, that's been a fun thing. And that started just before the lockdown happened. So I had a lot of time to play with that.
Just reading Lynch scripts and
reading Lynch scripts, and then also writing, trying to write a novel at the same time.
You know, and you didn't go batshit crazy. You didn't go Shining reading all those Lynch scripts.
No, actually, it's awesome. I've been a fan of his from way back. But lockdown was weird, you know, because I had two of my sons are in college. We're in college at the time when it first started, so they were like moving back home, right? Which was, oh, okay. Instead of at the summer, it's like we're home, right? And I had just gotten engaged, so it was like we were all in the house together, like at the same time, and that was challenging, you know, like four of, like, you know, it's great. And then, yeah, I mean, it was a lot of, like you do, you're on top of each other. There's a thing, whatever, but it kind of, the creativity just started ahead and go somewhere. You know what I mean? So, it can work, you know, like you said, circumstances, you know, work, you got to find your way to get through them and do your stuff. So
yeah.
Came up with the series, you know, like everyone I know was like trying to do something, you know, and
yeah,
I'd been approached, hey, let's do a podcast and we'll do this thing. And it'll be great because I could get all the, you know, my convention buddies and different, you know, B movie celebrities and, you know, all the horror guys and gals that come in and do stuff. And I'm like, yeah, but everybody's doing like, that was like, it was like a gluttony of brand new, you know, podcasts and everyone doing their stuff. I'm like, I kind of don't. It's like a lot of energy. It's like I don't have the energy to jump into that right now because everybody's jumping in right now. Like, mm-hmm. Let's find, just do something we want to do that's not, you know, like I don't have to sell anything anymore. You know, it's like I don't want to sell things anymore. I just want to like create and do stuff. And yeah, I mean, I do the job because you have to. Like, you know, I mean, it's fun working in the business. There's always work. You know, if you're willing to do stuff, there's always work coming up. Not the stuff you want to do, not your personal projects, but it's also making time for that personal stuff, you know. My son and my other son and his girl, they live out in LA now. And he works at a company, they do post services, and he's a coordinator moving into the edit room out there, which is cool, that's great. And there's one, he's producing like 5 different shows in post right now, and they're shooting everything. It's got to be 5K this and colorize this, the, you know, the other stuff. I'm like, oh, that's really awesome. He goes, but you know what? We got to put them out at. I'm like, what? He goes, 720. At the end of the day, mm-hmm. It's all 720. I'm like,
it's all 720.
I'm like, right. So why the hell are they shooting everything on frickin'? Why are they working at that capacity when you can do it at whatever, you know? Because he's like, well, what are you going to shoot the show on? I'm like, 1080, like the smallest little, like, I got a dozen little cameras rolling around. He was like, oh, I'm not going to go buy anything new. You know,
I'm going
like,
to shoot it at 1080 and I'm going to put it out at what?
720. Yeah.
1080. I'll put it out at 1080.
I'll do it right there. It's going to be what it is. I don't have to go up, you know?
Right.
I'm not, you know, unless you have the, whatever the 4K TV box, everything set up to watch something that was actually made that way. That's awesome. But I said, anyone watching, I don't care if it's American Horror Story or whatever you're watching on TV, it's nothing's what it was. You know, you're not seeing a 5K version of Jackal when you're watching.
No, you're not. Unless you've got like, unless you've got this 4K TV, and so it's so rare that they actually are going to pump it out at 4K.
Right. Who's going to broadcast?
I think you have to buy the Blu-rays or
yeah.
You know, I guess some streaming services offer the 4K. I think HBO Max offers the 4K.
Sure.
But I don't think all their content is 4K.
They can't. There's not enough bandwidth right there to do. Yeah. I mean, there is. Technically, they just make more. But you know, yeah, it is what it is. You know.
So what drives you? I mean, you kind of touched upon, you know, wanting to just do what you love, but you know, thinking upon what's your driving force? What drives you to do what you want to do?
Yeah, that's like the blessing and the curse, right? Because I mean, I know you have it. I know you do. If you're not if you can't shut the brain off, right? Like it's going, and at the most inopportune moments, whatever, you know, you're clicking onto some other idea. Like I'm sure you're down there doing a great job ADing on that movie and having a blast, but you know, you're going to hear or see something that's just going to trigger and your thought's going to shoot off from it. It's like, I got to touch back on that because that's an idea, like, and that's worth exploring. And that's like for most of it, I think like 1,000 times a day, you get like something just kind of triggers and like, oh, what, or you see, I could redo that, I could do whatever. That's hard. My wife and people now, they get when I mutter to myself about things that I'm just processing. It's not, I'm not, you know, I'm not old and senile. It's I'm having thoughts here and I'm like, yeah, I just got to get rid of that one because it's like, that's going nowhere, you know, and it just, so you go through at the end of the week, whatever it is, and you kind of figure like the 4 or 5 that are still sticking, they go in the book, right? They go in the log. I'll come back to these whenever, I don't know, but they stuck there all week. They kept coming back. That's the driving. It's like, it's not, it's like, you gotta be doing something to get rid of it.
Almost. Yeah.
Like you gotta get it out. And most of it's like, you know, I joke around about it. It's kind of like, I've seen certain people get really, really stoned and come up with an idea for something. They're high as a kite. And like, wouldn't this be the coolest thing if, and you want to just record that and play it back to them when you're sober, going, it was shit, right? But it made sense at the time.
Right.
But great. Like, I, you know, it's like, but so much of it kind of feels like that. Like you have this really great idea and then you're like, you play it out for a minute and it's like, it doesn't work. But then there's the other ones that do. And you like, this could be something. Maybe not now, maybe in a few years, maybe this, whatever. But there's never not something to do, you know, and there's never, I don't care if it's, you know, I had writer's block for a hot second on the novel, but doesn't mean I wasn't like outlining storylines for other screenplay. You know, it's like it just bumped over for a minute. I couldn't focus the 6 hours a day to write a freaking novel, but I could spend 20 hours cranking out three different concepts for other movies. You know, like I just, it hits when it hits and where it goes. And you know, I think it's just important to, like, you just follow through. You know you're not going to make 5% of it, you know, 99% of it. It's never going to happen because there's not enough time. You know, I don't have that many lives. I don't have that many hours. But
and it doesn't mean it should. And that's the driving force for me too. That's the driving force for me. It's like you said, there's only so many hours in a day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not going to live forever. It's, you know, pull the trigger on some stuff. Let's, you know.
Yeah, I've seen that floating around. And I forget who told me that. I think it was I was at a thing and Wes Craven said that. You know, and he's like, well, you know, people say, you know, you only live once. He goes, no, you die once. You live every freaking day until then.
Every day.
Like, shit. And he's like, you got to make use of it, you know. And this is what I was kind of griping about, kind of being pigeon, like not like me and Wes Craven were buddies, you know, or anything like that. But it was at a thing. And I knew, because he'd done the Mr. Holland's Opus, right? Which was a brilliant freaking movie away from Freddy Krueger or Scream. And, but what did he go back to? You know, he's like, I know where my bread and butter is, man. And he's like, it's so frustrating because he was a very intellectual, brilliant guy who wanted to so badly not have to make horror movies anymore. But if he did them, he did them really smart. And he was like, but, you know, it's kind of what I got to do. And, you know, and they shot Scream 4 here in Michigan and I just popped over and I was like, hey, you know, we're doing our, like, there's like that knowing, like, he's like, what you got? And I'm like, yeah, I'm doing this. He's like, yeah, okay, me too. Like, as you can see, I'm doing this fucking thing again. Not begrudgingly, not even like whatever, but it's like, hey, you know what? We can make people happy and we can enjoy this and we got good people around us. So let's make it happen. Let's have fun doing it. And I'm like, it is worth it. You see the reaction you get when an audience hits on something and they find it and they make it their own. That's the best thing ever, you know? And I was a part of a show I started years ago and I was traveling. I think it was in Burbank. I was at a thing in Burbank and somebody in the crowd came up and was talking to me about this show back in, because they found out I was from Detroit. They're like, you got to go see this show, blah, 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 back in Detroit, Motor City Nightmare. This is this thing. And I'm like, really? And they're telling me how cool this show was. And that was the best freaking feeling in the world to just hear somebody who had such a great experience at the event telling me how cool the show was. And I was like, oh yeah, I'll have to check that out. You know, like I'll have to go, whatever it was, but it was just, that's the kind of shit you just like, it makes up for those moments and boiling over months of frustration between financing and script delays or problems, you know, whatever. It's just those moments, or even it had happened, those 30 seconds that happened on camera that were completely that moment that just happened and everything fired and you got look over and you got chills, the crew standing there just anticipating the call for cut so everyone can just cheer and applaud you. And when that happened, you forget about the 3 years it took you to get to that fucking point to begin with. You're just like, and that's the special kind of stupid. That's the thing in all of us that you can't explain to the real working class out there. Like, yeah, I mean, I might not make all the money all the time, but when I hit on something like that, it feels really good. And I'm paying the bills, you know? And
absolutely.
Put three kids through college. I'm doing okay, but I'm not great. I'm not like the other guys, but you know, it's like I made a living doing the stuff that I really enjoy doing. It's frustrating and as painful and heartbreaking as that whole process is all at once. It's like, it's a special kind of stupid. That's the best way to put it.
Special kind of stupid. Yeah, you're right. I mean, for me, it is, I mean, the biggest return on investment, the biggest compound interest is my interest, mm-hmm. is my interest in what I do and my love of what I do. And I can pass that on to my kid. I was having a discussion with a buddy and saying, you know, I've had family members, I've had friends come home from work just in a shitty mood.
Sure.
Because they just hate their freaking job, and they're only working 8 hours a day.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I've been deployed in our shifts. Yeah. And luckily we weren't doing 12 hour or 16 hour or 24 hour shifts. We were doing 8 hour shifts on a certain deployment.
Sure.
And I felt exhausted. I felt drained. I just felt miserable. Mm-hmm. And then I've worked on 10 hour, 12 hour, 14 hour, 16 hour shoots, acting or on crew. Sure. And come home and still amped up. Wanted to tell my wife about it.
Breakfast. Let's go. Yeah. You're ready to go. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And
ready for the next day. And mm-hmm. so, you know, you come home, and now that I got a kid, it's like, I'm not going to come home miserable and want to just chug a six pack and sit in front of the TV. And I'm going to want to interact with my wife and kid. Hey, what an amazing day. Tell me about your day. I had such an amazing day. Can't wait to tell you about it. Talk about it, share it. And then, you know, interact with the kid. 'Cause I'm still amped up. I'm like, all right, now let's play toys or read me a book or I'll read you a book or something like that, you know? And so that's the ultimate return on investment. That's the ultimate compound interest interest.
Sure.
And back enjoyment.
And the investment that the sweat equity we put into this craft is just, it's unbelievable. And it's not, and it's like any other musician, you know, anyone in the creative or performing arts or whatever gets it. They get it. It's something you got to do, and you're not complete without it. I don't care if you're holding down a straight job. Like, I know a handful of painters, really brilliant painters. And, you know, one worked at a freaking like tile store, you know, like for countertops and, you know, mm-hmm. And because, you know, they had a kid, and it's like, I had to have insurance. I'm like, oh, I get that. I get doing that, and would work there 8 hours and then have to come home and then like set up and do dinner, whatever it is, and then start painting until 4 o'clock in the freaking morning when they got to get up at six. And like, is it worth it? Nah, not every night, but you know what? I was able to get this thing done. And it's like, that's what feeds my soul. The job pays the bills. This feeds my soul and makes me livable as a human being with everybody else I have to interact with, you know. And I love, same thing. I've got my three oldest boys are all in the business in some capacity, whether animators or, you know, they grew up on sets, they grew up being a part of this thing, and they grew up around enough, you know, modicum of like celebrity talent. So like, they're not impressed by, you know, like they're just like, I've been doing this since I was five, you know, like this is cool, this is whatever. But when they get excited about something which happens, and we can talk, like 3 hours can fly by on a phone like that when they've got a new project going.
Yeah.
And you know, my wife now, she's not in the business. She gets it. She's like, I see you guys. And it's just like this magical thing like happens, like this whole, like there's the muggle world, and then there's like people in entertainment, you know, it's like, and not the, whatever, the famous people, like the other 99% of the people in the entertainment business that are doing it just because we have to. And it's not, we're not expecting to be this, that, or whatever. That's not the goal. The goal is to just keep doing this and find a way to, you know, live along. And she's like, I see it. She goes, and it's freaking amazing. And they're so talented. She's like, I don't know why this doesn't happen. You know, like, why doesn't, you know, I'm like, 'cause it's with all of us. There's a million other people that are that freaking talented out there, and we're all have the same passion, and we're all doing this stuff. And it's not about who's going to sell that script for $1.5 million or whatever, you know, that bullshit. It's like, who's doing it, you know, period. Because, and they can get by, you know, and you have too. I know you have, like, people in the business who've had some really big successful moments for a handful of years, and then that goes away, you know, and they're back to like, yeah, I had to go jump on the forklift to get in the warehouse because we all do it. I get it. Like, that's like the rest of us. Well, you had a better shot because you had 3 years on freaking Xena Princess Warrior or whatever the hell you were doing down there. Awesome. Good for you, you know, but we all know it's fleeting. Any success is just, the monetary stuff is fleeting, you know. It's not gonna be forever. So,
and for me, you know, like, there's all these live events, you know, like there's conferences at the what you call a convention center or at a hotel. Sure. There's live streaming, and I would jump on those too, because not only are they, you know, kind of fun, they're free, there's free food, there's a free happy hour at the end, but I was learning a lot of tech stuff. And had I not done all this AV stuff and live streaming stuff, I wouldn't have the expertise to do a remote podcast at this point in my life.
Right.
And so, you know, it's for me, I set life. And so whether it's some live event, whether I'm doing audio or I'm opping a cam for a concert or a speech or a conference or a seminar, or whether it's a film, it's a commercial, it's a TV show, right. It's a music video. I mean, it's just, I'm always learning something, and sure. I'm always staying fresh. I'm getting ideas. Oh man, yeah. I just did some bizarre expo, you know, mm-hmm. for Microsoft, but I just mm-hmm. got this cool idea for the podcast. I mean, I could tweak the podcast right. because of something I learned how to do at this expo. I'll start taking notes on that, or, you know, get ideas for a film from somewhere and start writing.
But I think, you know, that's, it's part of that, the any kind of like creative brain or performance, you're always, we're thirsty, right? And we're empty vessels, man. We constantly need new input. So whether it's, like you said, I'll do anything for the experience. And I've had, you know, I've gone back and, you know, there were certain gigs where, you know, one of my people would be like, I really need some help. I know it's like beneath what you're used to. I'm like, oh, there's nothing, like, drop that out of your language. Like, I'll do it. And I need somebody to help out on this thing, whether it's like, you know, some tech job, whatever. I'll do it. I'm like, I'm there. If I'm interested, well, I shouldn't say that. If I'm interested in it, I'll be there. So yeah. Let me qualify that. So there's maybe some of that, like, it's got to be something I'm kind of already interested in, or I see an opportunity with, but I see a lot of opportunity. So I'm pretty much like, I don't say no very often to shit. So, I don't, I just like, and when
I have to agree. Yeah.
I don't say no to much. I mean, I really don't. It's like, well, it only pays this. I'm not obviously. Okay, great. You know, that pays awesome anyway, but, I'm just doing it because I'm curious about whatever, like, how does that process happen? Whatever, like you're saying, like you're always thinking about different things, and that's not always about what's going to be in the next story, but it's like, oh, another thing, another skills. Like, the more tools in your toolbox, the better you are. You know what I mean? Like, you feel better. I do. But there was, at the beginning of the pandemic, you know, I did a lot of live shows, produced a lot of live events and whatever it was. Right. And that's fun. It's great. And I knew, in fact, I was in Cleveland right before the lockdown happened doing another auto show. And they're like, well, we're going to postpone the whatever till like August. I'm like, this ain't going to, like, I'm like, you guys have no idea what's coming. Like, we weren't in official lockdown. This was like middle, end of February. I'm like, this is not going great. Like, I'm not counting on any gigs for the rest of the whatever, especially right. live 200,000 people a day through a freaking arena to look at cars. Like, that shit's gone. Like, mm-hmm. like, get loose. And then, so right away, everyone's scrambling for this. And then one of the agencies I used to work with, they're doing all the remote, you know, remote things, right? They're doing these big Zoom meetings, and they're hiring us as producers coming in to basically host like Zoom meetings and breakout rooms and all this other shit. I'm like, this is great for right now, but in 3 weeks, we're not going to be necessary because they're going to have like three admins sitting in an office that realize they don't need to hire six producers to come in and do this shit. This is not a live show like we're used to. You know, we're not on the ground running. It's three people could be doing this stuff from a QB somewhere or their living room, like we were doing ours, you know? So things like came up and then dropped away really quickly. Cause it's like, people saw how, and I'm not saying this in a negative way, but another writer was talking about it just a couple of days ago. Like, we're really unnecessary in the scheme of like what's going on in the world right now. He says, we're not police. We're not frontline worker. We're here. Like, when you get around to wanting to be entertained or something, or you got some important product you want to sell, like that car, when people are not thinking about buying cars right now. And yeah. And then it kind of, that was a thing, right? We're not really necessary. The entertainment side of it, sure. People want escapism. They want to be entertained. They want to do whatever to get out of it. That's fine. But the nuts and bolts of how important is that show really? How important is that next big product launch for Apple or whoever, like, no one's really going to care right now, you know, not like they used to. And there's no reason to spend $5 million a day putting on some sort of extravagant, you know, mind blowing light show, LED, whatever, you know, it's like, no one's, you know, it's not, the hype's not there anymore. It's just people aren't buying it, you know? And that was kind of like with my auto show, end of my, not the end of it, but I've been, they've been declining. Auto shows are kind of like, I think they're never going to be what they were anyway, but they were, that was the way they were heading before the pandemic. And one of the clients I worked with was complaining about one of the cars on the floor didn't have the right floor trim package on it or something like that. And they had all signed off on what was on the floor. And it's not like we can just bring in another car. You know, it's like, it's in the middle of the display and it takes weeks to get that kind of shit organized and prepped and in there and so on. And I would, and it was the Saturday, the Wednesday before the Saturday, Sunday closes the show or something like that. So we're already through the second week of the show. I'm like, you're just noticing this now. And they're like, well, I'm not happy about it. I'm like, well, you signed off. Like, here's your initial on the bottom of the Bible. Like, you signed off on that specific VIN number. And I'm like, hey, you know, but take it easy, because it's not like we're like curing cancer or like performing open heart surgery on infants here. This is like selling a car to people that can't afford it anyway. You know, like, right. How important is that Impala? You know, when, in the scheme of what we're doing here, do you think anyone else cares what trim package is on that car? Because it's not the whatever version of this whatever. I'm like, it's like, find something else to be upset about, man. Like, it's not that big a deal. And again, not dismissing their job, but it's like, I think we all kind of got to get right size in our heads about what's really important. Yeah. And it's okay that's important to you or to me or what, that's the main thing, right? If it's important to you, it's important, period. And if you're around like-minded people, that's going to be great. You're going to find that thing. And you're going to find that audience, you know, like, that's the thing, is people are going to find you and click with you because they do, you know. And it's not like you're going to grow on them over time. They're going to keep coming back to your, you know, for your podcast, for example, because why? Like, they either like you or they kind of don't from the beginning. And if they kind of don't, they're probably not coming back. But if they find something of relatability or, you know, like, they're going to check it out again. If it's a good question, if it's whatever, so don't sweat it. You know, it's like, let's just do what we do. Enjoy it. Enjoy the ride, man. Cause you know, we're all getting out at the same place and it's not fun. Right. We're not going past that. No one's going past that place at the end of the road. You know, it's exactly, like, that's it. We're all done there. So.
Yeah, man. Well, hey, Todd Brunswick, I can't thank you enough for coming on, man. Creative strategist, storyteller, dream weaver, executive producer. Right? Yeah, man. Brunswick Creative Group. And I mean, like you were talking about the Carnage series, lots of other horror zombie movies, you know, zombie filmmaker and zombie squad cast, of course. Sure. TJ Brunswick 214 on Instagram. Todd, I can't thank you enough for coming on and
cool, man. No, I appreciate it.
Sharing all the stories, and don't go anywhere. We'll chat.